Les conférences du Collège de France.
Merci à tous d'être venus. Nous accueillons aujourd'hui le professeur Louis Juncker. Le professeur Louis Juncker est spécialiste des deux livres des chroniques dans la Bible, mais aussi de l'exégèse interculturelle et multidimensionnelle. Il a d'abord étudié le grec et l'hébreu à l'université de Stellenbosch en Afrique du Sud, avant d'y faire son doctorat avec une thèse intitulée « Exclusivité et variété, perspective sur l'exégèse multidimensionnelle ». Après quoi il est devenu successivement senior lecturer à cette même université, puis professeur associé, avant de devenir professeur ordinaire en 2010. Il écrit la plupart de ses articles en anglais et en afrikaans, et le dernier de ses livres, paru très récemment, est un commentaire complet sur les deux livres des chroniques, publiés chez Westminster John Knox dans la série Old Testament Library. Je vous disais tout à l'heure qu'il était spécialiste à la fois des chroniques et de l'exégèse interculturelle, et ces deux conférences qu'il va donner aujourd'hui et lundi prochain porteront justement sur ces deux sujets à la fois. Merci beaucoup au professeur Juncker d'avoir fait le déplacement depuis l'Afrique du Sud jusqu'ici, et je lui laisse la parole.
Merci Matteo, madame et monsieur. Now that's where my French stops, unfortunately. But I know one further sentence, namely, je ne parle pas français. So now I've used all the French words that I know, but at least I recognized a few others when you spoke, Matteo. Thank you for the introduction. And let me at this point also just acknowledge Thomas Römer. Professor Römer is a well-known person in our field, and he's well-respected also in South Africa. He's become a good friend of South African Old Testament scholarship. He will probably look at this recording afterwards. So I think we should give him a round of applause on the honorary doctorate that he is receiving at the University of Pretoria this week. I heard that Matteo mentioned that, so I therefore also take the liberty to mention that to you. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to speak about changing biblical interpretation, but then quite important, you should note that there's a question mark behind it. It's a problem that I would like to introduce, and specifically also from my South African context. There will be two talks, the one today and then the second one next Monday. Today it's about socio-political transformation and biblical interpretation, the case of post-apartheid South Africa. Now, I'm actually reading from my own computer and showing you the French translation to help you a little bit, and for those who are the online audience. Matteo, can I appoint you then, if I forget to, that you just point your finger to the screen and I will remember to do so. Let me give you an overview of the two parts of this lecture today. Part A will be simply a theoretical and a hermeneutical framework. Now, the word hermeneutics is probably well known to many of you or to all of you, but it's, one could say, the theory of interpretation or thinking, reflecting on how interpretation takes place. And then the second part of the lecture will be on socio-political transformation and biblical interpretation in post-apartheid South Africa. Now, the first part in the theoretical and hermeneutical framework. I would like to start then by problematizing the old issue that I've put on the table. And that is namely, can or even may the interpretation of the Bible be changed or change over time? Now, this I'm not so sure about your context because I don't know it so well, but in my context, this is quite a prominent question because people are fairly conservative in their biblical interpretation. You will hear also that I come from the Dutch Reformed tradition, and within this Protestant tradition in South Africa, there's a fairly conservative way of dealing with the Bible. And the reason why people are very careful how to answer this question is namely because their definition of Holy Scriptures is in a certain sense working with an understanding of the biblical canon as a fixed collection of books, and that those books are sort of the rule according to which one should also conduct yourself. Now, this is in all Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, with their different holy scriptures. That's more or less a tendency that occurs in all three those religious groups. And those people are normally seeing then what is written in the Bible as sort of timeless truths. That means that they were written long ago, but they are actually also applying to today. Now, sometimes this is creating problems even for people who work with that kind of frame of understanding, because they realize that many of the things that we read about in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, cannot be applied in exactly the same way in our time. So the understanding of timeless truths is also problematic, and that is why I have a question mark there as well. Now, one could ask, but what conditions would necessitate then changes in our interpretation of the Bible? I've asked the question, may we and can we change the interpretation of the Bible? What conditions would necessitate that? What would lead to the need of changing interpretation? Now, I will later on explain what I mean with changing interpretation, but at this stage, then simply historical distance. The fact that we are working with a Bible, which is literally thousands of years, many millennia, or actually many centuries old, and it's telling a story of more than two millennia. So that's the historical distance created also by the texts and the origin of the text. If we know something about it, we know this is not a book that was written yesterday or the day before. It comes from a time long ago. Now, so that's the one thing that could problematize our interpretations and why it would be necessary then to change our interpretations. But then the other thing is changing contexts of interpretation. Now, of course, we are also not tabula rasa when we read the Bible, because we also have our own ideological makeup, our contexts, socio-political, socio-economic contexts. I live on the African continent, most of you live on the European continent, and so on and so on. So that's quite an interesting awareness then, that changing contexts also in modern day situations could lead then to changing interpretation, that interpretation should be adapted and can be adapted. Now, at this point, I just want to point out that these two points that I've mentioned here, historical distance on the one hand and changing contexts of interpretation, are actually sort of working on two extreme points of the chronological continuum. On the one hand, the time of origin of the Bible, but then on the other hand, the time of interpretation also in our own context. Now, I will later on say something about that, but we cannot only call modern-day interpretations contextual as if we are the only ones or the first ones to interpret the Bible within our contexts. Also, the origin of the Bible is actually contextual. It was driven also by socio-political and socio-religious factors, which we will talk about later today, but also then next week. Now, in the next screen, I just quickly want to take you through some of the main philosophers that I rely upon. Of course, there are many more that one can speak about having had an influence on the interpretation of the Bible or on hermeneutics, on the understanding, the project of understanding. Now, I call this thing from philosophical to biblical hermeneutics. These persons discussed here were not in the first place biblical scholars thinking about biblical interpretation, although in some of those scholars' work, we also see the deliberate engagement with the issue of biblical interpretation. Now, when we come to Hans-Georg Gadamer, a German philosopher, he understood biblical interpretation through philosophical hermeneutics, emphasizing dialogue between the text and the interpreter. He rejected the idea that interpreters can recover an entirely objective original meaning detached from history. Instead, understanding occurs through a fusion of horizons, and that's sort of the famous term used by Gadamer. Understanding occurs through a fusion of horizons, where the historical world of the text and the interpreter's present context interact. Tradition and prejudice are not obstacles, but necessary starting points, he would say, for interpretation. Now, for Gadamer, biblical texts, and he engaged also with the issue of biblical interpretation, biblical texts remain living voices that continually speak anew in changing situations. Interpretation is therefore participatory, historical, and communal, shaped through language, conversation, and openness to truth disclosed within the interpretive encounter itself over time. So here you can hear already in Gadamer's work some of the things that I've discussed in an opening statement or opening problem statement, that if the Bible remains then also voices speaking through the ages, then it should be logical that we should also consider the issue of changing interpretations. Paul Ricoeur, who is certainly, you're not a stranger to him, being on French ground here. Now, Paul Ricoeur viewed biblical interpretation as a dynamic encounter between text and reader. He argued that scripture gains meaning through interpretation rather than literal recovery of an author's intention. So he's moving away also from the point that there was some author or authors behind the text and that we should interpret it in line with the intention of the authors. Now, drawing on phenomenology and hermeneutics, Ricoeur emphasized symbols, metaphors, and narratives as vehicles that disclose deeper truths about human existence and about faith. He distinguished between a hermeneutics of suspicion, which critiques ideology and illusion, and a hermeneutics of restoration, which recovers meaning and hope. Now, for Paul Ricoeur, biblical texts invite readers into self-understanding, ethical reflection, and imaginative participation in worlds opened by the text itself through language, memory, and communal religious practice. Now, there are some tensions between Gadamer and Ricoeur that I'm not going into now, but you will hear that elements of both will also later on play a role in my own understanding. Michel Foucault did not develop a formal theory of biblical interpretation, but his ideas profoundly influenced modern readings of scripture. He examined how power, knowledge, and discourse shape truth claims within institutions, including in religion. Applied to the Bible, Foucault's approach asks how interpretations reinforce authority, regulate behavior, and define orthodoxy or deviance. He emphasized that meaning emerges within historical and social systems rather than from timeless truths alone. And there you get the phrase that I've used also earlier. Biblical texts are therefore studied as part of networks of power, discipline, ideologies, and identity formation. Foucauldian interpreters often analyze how scripture has been used to shape sexuality, morality, gender, punishment, and social control historically. So you will see how these three philosophers also play a role in my own formulation of a hermeneutics of change or hermeneutics of continuity. Now, let me give you an overview of the biblical hermeneutical shifts from the 18th till the 21st century, and I'm going to summarize that sort of in four stages. One could say that until the first quarter of the first two decades, more or less, of the 20th century, the emphasis was very much in biblical interpretation on historical analysis and understanding. That means that people emphasized, particularly then also in the German historical scholarship, that if you can't recover the history behind the texts, then you can't really understand it. You have to see whether you can get to the intention of the authors and to see whether that can also help you in your own understanding. Now, the focus on history was influenced also very strongly in the 19th century through positivism, historism, idealism, and the whole idea also in biblical scholarship was that we are in a certain sense implying or employing this model of gradual development over time in our understanding of the biblical texts, in the analysis of the Hebrew Bible into younger material and older materials. One of the famous fathers of the so-called historical critical method was Julius Wellhausen, who in the 1880s published a book in which he then actually was trying to give a description of the religion history of ancient Israel. But then when he started doing that, he realized that before he can do so, he has to analyze where are these texts dated in the past, because it seems that it's not simply Genesis 1 verse 1 is the oldest verse and then the last verse is the youngest verse. It is, in a certain sense, an amalgamation of different literatures from different periods, and before one does not have that understanding of when the literature originated and were in use, then one cannot really make such a description. So in the end, he discovered then also that some of the stories that we considered, or that was traditionally considered to be quite old, are actually some of the youngest stories, and particularly also the views on the Torah. The legal materials in the Hebrew Bible are some of the youngest because it witnesses to specifically then the sophisticated organization of the cult. Now, from the second decade of the 20th century, we see that slowly an emphasis came on textual analysis and understanding. And I would say that this movement has also influenced particularly Paul Ricoeur in his emphasis also on structures, narratives, and so on. Now, this was then a movement which particularly focused on the texts themselves. And the New Criticism, that was a movement in general literary studies that started emphasizing also that a literary work is a work of art. I mean, as soon as the ink on paper is dry, then the literature starts having its own life. You don't have to go behind the text in order to understand it. Now, some of the directions that came up in this stage, structuralism, which was also very much influenced by French scholars, formalism, particularly Russian scholars, semiotics, narratology, all those things started having a sort of a very prominent place in biblical interpretation. Now, the point here is namely that the focus shifted completely and that there was nothing of the historical understanding that was taken over. And one understands that also after the Great War, 1914 to 18, this whole idea of positivism and historicism and idealism and so on was in a certain sense uprooted. And people had no trust in the past any longer, but then no historical sort of understanding came also with this development in the middle of the 20th century. I don't know whether you know the expression, but in Afrikaans, my mother tongue, and in English we have the expression, the baby was thrown out with the bathwater. Do you know that expression? It seems so. Now, the baby of historical understanding was in a certain sense thrown out with the bathwater and everything remained with the texts. Then from the 1960s onwards, we could say that the emphasis shifted then to contemporary contexts of understanding. People became aware, particularly also under the influence of socio-political movements. You know also that since the 1960s, there was a huge decolonization movement also on the African continent and elsewhere in the world. But in these contexts, people started emphasizing that the contexts within which they are hearing the biblical texts influence them also in their understanding. Now, so therefore, the focus shifted then to the ideological positions. Namely, we speak of genitive theologies, which is actually sort of defined into different branches. One could speak of liberation or theology of liberation, feminist interpretations, African interpretations, and so on, where a specific ideological viewpoint is taken as point of departure and is emphasized in that specifically assists us also in our interpretations or influences us in our interpretation. Now, again, the baby was thrown out with the bathwater, or two babies by now were thrown out of the with the bathwater, the historical understanding as well as the textual understanding. Now, from the last decade of the 20th century, I would make the observation that a slow movement is starting to occur, namely an emphasis on textual and historical understanding. I have used the word multidimensionality in my dissertation, which Matteo also mentioned. That means that we are convinced that the biblical interpretation process is too complex to only approach it from one angle, either from historical or textual or contextual angles. So therefore, this is very much under the influence of postmodernism, the understanding of diversity also in our own time, non-exclusivism, multidimensionality. Those things are in a certain sense then the important buzzwords within this more multidimensional understanding. So this is not this is actually not a new method or a new approach. It's rather another attitude in the interpretation of the Bible. It's not trying to take the best of all methods and put them together in a super method and then you claim that you can do everything with that. It's rather an alternative attitude with which the historical, the textual, and the contextual aspects are sort of used in the interpretation process. Now, just the very basics, this is not even first year of work, it's below first year work, so please forgive me that I'm putting this on the table, but this is in any case sort of also a point of departure for the rest of the lecture. Insights from biblical science in Hebrew Bible interpretation. Now, the basic information about the origin of the Hebrew Bible, and take note that the Hebrew Bible has the same number of books than the Protestant Christian Old Testament. Those of you know who are in a Catholic tradition would know that the Catholic Bible has more books in the Old Testament. That goes back to the Septuagint, the Greek translation, as well as the Latin translation. But within Protestantism, they sort of went ad fontes, back to the sources, which was then the shorter version of the Hebrew Bible canon. So therefore, they are in parallel with one another. Now, basic information that we should, of course, take into account when we speak about the origin of the Bible is, first of all, and I've mentioned that already, the biblical texts were originated actually long ago. That means in ancient West Asian, or as we used to call it, Near Eastern world, from the end of the second millennium BCE into the first millennium BCE, we see then that there was a world behind the text long ago. And there are all kinds of cultural differences that we have to take into account, not only between our world and the world of the Bible, but also as the developments took place over time, also different cultural environments. And that leads then to the second logical point, namely, if we emphasize the long ago, we also should emphasize the over a long period of time. And this is the one aspect that is often neglected in biblical interpretation. One could say that the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible originated through various imperial regimes in interaction with those imperial regimes, and particularly then from the Assyrian to the Babylonian to the Persian to the Hellenistic to the Seleucid to the Roman empires. So this is all the empires that the biblical, that they had to negotiate in a certain sense in bringing about these texts. But then the one important thing is namely that younger texts can incorporate, modify, and reinterpret older basis textual traditions. Next time we will speak in more depth about Chronicles, and Chronicles is the best example to illustrate that, because Chronicles is changing interpretations. So I'm not going to go into that, otherwise next week I will have nothing to say, but this is quite important, the over long period of time. The Bible, in a certain sense, the Hebrew Bible incorporates many different centuries, many different imperial existences, and those played into the contextuality of origin of the Hebrew Bible. Okay, so let's come to part B then. Now, this is now bringing it, this theory that I've discussed now, bringing it more to the South African context. As you have seen, that my case study that I'm going to speak about is actually then also the interpretation of the Bible in post-apartheid South Africa, but I'm going to start already in the apartheid phase so that you can also notice how the changes took place from there. So socio-political transformation and biblical interpretation from the apartheid era into the post-apartheid South Africa, one could say. Now, biblical interpretation in the time of apartheid is something that we not often look at because we want to forget it. But that is why it's so important also to analyze that again so that we do not step into the same ditches again in terms of our interpretations of the Bible. Now, in this stage, and I'm speaking from, say, the 1950s until the more or less the end of the 1980s, we could see then some opposing interpretations, for example, on the Exodus tradition in the same context, namely white Afrikaans-speaking people like me and my parents and the group from which we come from. White Afrikaans-speaking people are the chosen people of God, so we were learned, so we were taught actually, are the chosen people of God who were placed on the southern tip of Africa to bring the light of Christianity to the continent, and then often also in a European guise. Now, this then gradually gave also rise to a discussion within, especially the Dutch Reformed Church, where people started negotiating in a certain sense through theology also some political system of apartheid. Now, apartheid is an Afrikaans word, and it's a bit of a shame that that's the word that the whole world has taken over from us, but that's, I think, quite a accurate description of what was actually done at that stage. Now, in 1974, a development of over two decades, in a certain sense, culminated in a document that was published by the Dutch Reformed Church. In Afrikaans, the name is Rasvolk in Nazi in die Licht van die Schrift. In the English translation, Racial Relations in Light of Scripture, and you have the French translation of the title also there. Now, so that was the interpretation of the Exodus narrative, namely that white people are sort of the, they are the people who are chosen and so on, and they are now in the promised land, and they bring the light of Christianity to this dark continent. Simultaneously, within liberation theology, and particularly then also within oppressed black people, that means the majority of the society of South Africa, people understood themselves then as the chosen people of God. So just the opposite identification. They saw then the white Afrikaans regime, the apartheid regime, as the Pharaoh in Pretoria, was he called. I mean, the prime minister or the president of South Africa was seen as the Pharaoh who is oppressing us and making us slaves, and we have to be freed from this bondage. So oppressed black people are the chosen people of God who will be led out of bondage into the promised land. So when the new regime in South Africa started, the so-called New South Africa, then it was sort of, for black people in the country, mostly then also, now we are entering the promised land. While simultaneously for another part of the community of the South African society, it was just the opposite. Now we are going into bondage, but we will talk about that later on. Now, in this liberation struggle, and you probably know also these South African names, famous names like Dr. Alan Busak was one of the main proponents of this direction in theology. Also Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Reverend Beyers Nodia, who was a white Afrikaans person. He was actually also a minister of religion within the Dutch Reformed Church, but he then chose also to leave the church and to stand on the side of the oppressed. And so they, especially these people, played quite an interesting and important role within liberation struggle. Now, this is only to use a brief example from the Exodus tradition, but the text that actually played the biggest role in the formulation of apartheid was actually Genesis 11, the Tower of Babel narrative. Now, there are many other verses that were also interpreted very literally, such as in Genesis 9 and 10, where it said that the Chemites should serve the Shemites and the Japhethites. So Ham or Cham, as we pronounce it, was seen then as the African people. That identification was made. But those are sort of based on smaller literal readings of certain verses. But the text that was sort of analyzed in depth in this document, Rasvolk en Nazi, is actually Genesis 11. And just to remind us of the contents of this text, let me just quickly read through it. It's probably big enough for you to follow there in the French. I read it in the English. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth." And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the earth, and from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of the earth. Okay, so how was this text interpreted then within the Rasvolkenazi document, the document which formed the basis of the theological legitimation of apartheid ideology? Now, it's quite a sophisticated argument that was made there, and that is quite confusing in a certain sense. The first question that was asked to this text was actually, what was the sin committed at Shinar? Now, maybe you would know that the traditional interpretation of this was actually that the building of a tower was seen as a symbolic of people wanting to be like God. So it was, in a certain sense, their own attempts to rise up to heaven that was seen as the sin. But in Rasvolkenazi, it was interpreted differently. It said, no, it was not a vertical sin that people sinned against God, but it was rather a horizontal sin. And they referred then to Genesis 1 verse 28, where it says in the creation account, "And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." So this document says then that the people on the plain of Shinar at Babel did not do that. They congregated in one place, and they did not be fruitful and multiply, did not multiply and did not fill the earth as it was commissioned in Genesis 1 verse 28. So you can see it's not a sin against God, directly against God, people wanting to be like God, but it's rather horizontal, that people congregated in one place, which was not, according to Genesis 1 verse 28, the will of God. Now, one can say many things about this. If we take the datings of the texts and so on, it's most probable that Genesis 1 verse 28 only came after the texts that we have in Genesis 11. That is one traditional view on it, which already would indicate that that's not a legitimate connection to make in the texts. The second question that people asked then was, what was the intention of God with the confusion of languages? Now, the traditional interpretation was namely to say, that was the punishment of God for people who wanted to be like God. That was the punishment for those human beings who wanted to climb up to heaven to also be like God. Now, in Rasvolkenazi, it is interpreted not as a negative punishment, but rather as a positive blessing or positive providence. It says that human beings on their own could not manage to be obedient to Genesis 1 verse 28, and therefore God made a plan, so to speak, and the intention of God was then, with the confusion of languages, to spread the peoples all over the world so that they can fill the world and be fruitful and multiply and so on, as Genesis 1 verse 28 says. Now, again, these two interpretations or answering of the two questions were, for the time in the 1970s, actually quite strange. I mean, people particularly also then from the Swiss context, the Dutch context, the German context, and so on, the World Council of Church context, people emphasized and said, this is not the traditional interpretation. If we go to the historical critical commentaries, this is not how we interpret this text, and rightly so. But quite the interesting thing is namely, and I will say more about that later on, is namely that some of the modern interpretations from the 1990s onwards worked exactly with the same kind of interpretation. I once also studied the work of Ellen van Volde. She is a Dutch scholar who works from the perspective of semiotics, and she analyzed Genesis 11 exactly in the same way. And I contacted Ellen and I said, Ellen, do you know that you made exactly the same analysis of the text in Genesis 11 like the Ras Volkanazi document in South Africa? And she was totally shocked. Said she was, of course, not intending to legitimate some racial divisions and so on like the case in South Africa. So you see that the exegetical part alone is not everything. The exegetical part, of course, plays quite an important role, but it's not everything, because in the case of the Ras Volkanazi, the line goes very quickly from different languages to different peoples to different nations and then to different races. So within that kind of logic, then this document could say, well, therefore apartheid or separate development is actually in line with what Genesis 11 intended. Now, again, just make sure that you understand that I'm talking about the document now. I'm not saying this is my position, certainly not so, but I'm speaking about the document. So different languages, peoples, nations, and then races. Now, so that was in 1974, sort of the climax of the theological formulation also of apartheid. And that was taken up by the church, the Dutch Reformed Church, and they based their policy also of supporting apartheid on this analysis of Genesis 11. Now, not long afterwards, only 12 years later, and you would know that in the life of any church, 12 years is actually very quick. But then a new document was published, 1986, by the same Dutch Reformed Church, namely Kerk en Samenleving was it called, or Church and Society. And it was actually then giving simply the opposite interpretation, not of Genesis 11, but of the political situation in South Africa. And in 1986, in that document, for the first time, the Dutch Reformed Church came to the point of saying that membership of the church is open to everybody. It's not our color, our race that determines membership, but rather whether people are believing in God and in Jesus Christ. So that was sort of a pushback against the 1974 document of Ras Volkanazi. But to position this now within the historical developments in South Africa, the political developments actually, let us quickly look at the timeline. Remember 1974, Ras Volkanazi, 1986, Church and Society. So let's quickly run through this. September 1989, 3 years after the Kerk en Samenleving, Church and Society document. Then the then president, F.W. de Klerk, became then president of South Africa. On 11th of February 1990, Nelson Mandela was then released after 27 years of imprisonment, and he was unbanned, and the organizations of the ANC and the SACP were unbanned. And let me just say at that on that date, almost everybody in South Africa knows where you were on that date. And my wife and I, we remember that we were actually in Paris on the 11th of February 1990. We were tourists there, and the evening when we came to our hotel room, we saw on television for the first time in our lives how Nelson Mandela looked like and how he walked out of prison. So that's quite a landmark in the development of politics. Now look at this. October 1990, in the same year, the Synod of the Dutch Reformed Church then declared that apartheid is a sin. The 27th of April 1994, we had our first democratic elections and the initiation, one could say, of the new South Africa. The first democratic parliament was elected and the new South Africa came from that. Archbishop Desmond Tutu used to call that the Rainbow Nation, which is, of course, a little bit of an over-romanticizing of the South African nation, but that was sort of the euphoria of the time. Then, in October 1994, the Synod of the Dutch Reformed Church invited then President Nelson Mandela, no, sorry, he was still not president, it was before the constitution was accepted, but invited Nelson Mandela, and they asked forgiveness for the sin of apartheid to Mandela personally. So that synod is known as the Synod of Reconciliation. Then 1994 to 1996, there was a convention for a democratic society, and it was actually in that period that the new constitution of South Africa was written. In 1996, that was then accepted by parliament, and it's a constitution standing on the principles of non-discrimination on the grounds of race, gender, religion, language, and so on. So you can see the change over from 1974 to 1986, and then suddenly this whole line of historical events that followed after that. Now, what happened in terms of biblical interpretation then? Now, at that stage, it was quite interesting that particularly in the white Afrikaans community and the Dutch Reformed Church, there was a response which was totally different than in the black community in South Africa. Like before, I've given you the example of the Exodus tradition, which was, in a certain sense, interpreted just in the opposite ways. Again, what happened in 1994, 96, and so on, was interpreted sort of in opposite ways. Now, within the Dutch Reformed Church, the white Afrikaans-speaking church, members of the church started asking this question: why do pastors tell us with the Bible in their hand that apartheid is a sin, while a few decades ago, pastors told us with the same Bible in their hand that apartheid was the will of God? I mean, just take for a moment, I mean, the confusion in people's minds. I mean, just the other day, 1974, you said that apartheid is actually the providence of God to separate us so that we can fill the earth and so on. And just a few years later then, with the same Bible in their hands, the pastors then said that apartheid was a sin. Now, this question, of course, had political and ideological overtones, but what is quite important for me as somebody looking at the process of biblical interpretation, it's also a question of hermeneutical significance. It is, in a certain sense, actually the question, can we then change our interpretations of the Bible? The theme of the two talks that I will also deliver here. So there was an intense awareness then that the Bible itself contains contradictory perspectives. People started realizing, but all the years they did not see those contradictions in the Hebrew Bible. For example, Jonah was actually talking about a prophet who did not accept God's view that there is also salvation beyond the borders of Israel in Nineveh, in the Assyrian capital. Or then the contrast between Ruth and Ezra and Nehemiah. In Ezra and Nehemiah, we see that foreign women had to be chased out of the community in order to protect the holy seed as it is motivated there. Then the book of Ruth comes and it tells the story of a Moabitess, that means somebody from outside, becoming actually one of the ancestresses of King David, and per implication in Christianity then also of Jesus Christ. So people suddenly started realizing, but here we have all these contrasts and contradictions in the Bible, and we will have to look at that again. Now it's quite interesting that within the black community, this event or the political shifts in this time actually also opened up some questions, namely, should we persist with the liberation hermeneutics? That means, should we still fight for liberation in our theology after we have already been liberated in our political system? So slowly within the black churches, the shift takes place from a liberation hermeneutics to hermeneutics of reconstruction. And very quickly then, people within the black communities, black churches then used the book of Ezra and Nehemiah and said, well, this is a good biblical paradigm for the rebuilding after the exile. Now, of course, then people started discovering the exclusivism that we have in Ezra and Nehemiah about foreign women having to be chased away and so on. So then, and I will say something more about that next week, but then some people started saying, no, Chronicles is a better biblical paradigm also for arguing this shift from a hermeneutics of liberation to a hermeneutics of reconstruction. Now, in my own work, what happened also is namely that a shift also took place in my own work. That was actually in the early 90s when I wrote my dissertation, and I started becoming aware of a subfield which is actually little known even until today, and that is the field of empirical biblical hermeneutics. Now, what that means is actually that we say that we've developed many different methods for the exegetical side to analyze the world behind the text, but we have almost no methods or tools with which we can describe the process of interpretation also in our own times. So therefore, in my own work and together with some colleagues, we started trying to formulate all kinds of definitions of what would be adequacy in interpretation. When is an interpretation adequate? Now, of course, that was in our very young and ambitious days when we tried to sort of be normative in our understanding. This and this and this is needed in an interpretation, then it will be a good interpretation. But we suddenly or slowly started realizing that's not realistic. We should not be normative, but rather descriptive in terms of empirical hermeneutics. That means that we also then try to describe all the factors that play into our interpretations of the Bible, that we give account of the ideologies that are also behind our interpretations of the Bible, and that in the end will lead us then also to what we could call then a more adequate interpretation. Now within this then developed then also what could be called intercultural hermeneutics. That's sort of an outflow of the development of empirical hermeneutics. People started saying, but okay, when everybody in his or her little corner interprets the Bible, then we can see, of course, what factors are influencing them. But what if we bring different cultural environments together? And in South Africa, we have the world in one country in terms of diversity, in terms of diversity of races and so on. So intercultural hermeneutics was actually then an attempt also to see what if we bring people of different cultural environments together, that they read the same biblical texts but from their own cultural environments. And that they then, after that, start going into a dialogue about why do I interpret this in this way, or why did you interpret it in that way, and so on. So that is then what we would call dialogue a la Gadamer, that is a sort of an engaged dialogue where you are open to the understanding of the other and where you are open also to be changed in your own views. So intercultural encounters or intercultural Bible reading exercises have become then also very transformational ways of dealing with the Bible in churches. But then one should also at this stage emphasize, there was a reappraisal or a re-evaluation of the role of the historical aspects. Because we know that when we bring different cultural environments in our own world together, what about the differences with the cultural environments behind the biblical texts? So therefore also what factors contributed to the formation of ancient biblical texts? And we speak about then socio-political transformations. I mentioned to you already all the different empires, then various ideological positions and the importance of redaction criticism, and I will illustrate it very shortly after this. But you can see then that people started realizing that when we do this intercultural Bible reading and when we describe our own contemporary biblical interpretations, then we should also deal again with the historical aspects to see what cultural environments are also behind those texts and what ideological positions are behind those texts. Now, redaction criticism is a method in biblical studies which is actually playing quite an important role also at the moment. And one of the main people advocating this is also your own Professor Thomas Römer. who also did quite a lot of work in terms of this, and I'm going to conclude now by just quickly running through an article that he has written on Genesis 11. And he wrote it without referring, in one footnote he says that unfortunately in South Africa it was interpreted also to motivate apartheid, but it was actually then what he calls a post-colonial reading of Genesis 11 verse 1 to 9. And in this article he says, well, this story actually is not one story. We have two stories here. The first story is the following, and I'm going to read it to you and then show you the second story. The first one is verse 2. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. So do you see in this section, it's only about building a city. And then God decides to disperse the people. But then at a later stage, and both these stages played out in the Persian period, as sort of polemics against the imperial regimes of their time. Look at this. This is now the story as we have it in our Bibles, where the pieces in white are actually then redactions to this text, and you will see that the notion of language, you can see then that in the white parts, that's the only place where we actually have the issue of language and the name of Babel. So that was then also to identify this empire in a certain sense as Babylon, which was then no longer in existence. It was during the Persian period. But so he goes into, Thomas Remer goes into a sophisticated argument to show how this was actually then also an ideological interpretation, which was actually anti-colonial, anti-imperial at this stage. Now, this is just a short example. Next time we will deal more then with the process of biblical interpretation, and particularly then also the Book of Chronicles. So that is all for today, and I invite you to ask questions if you have some.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.